this is the biggest crisis that I have seen in terms of a belief in our system of our values. It's the biggest crisis because it challenges everything that we believe in, which is, you know, human rights and the value of the human life.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today is Fintan Drury, who's been prominent in journalism, communications, business and sport in a long career that included many successes and more than a few scars. Fintan, thanks for coming in for the podcast. We've known each other and been friends for, well, over 40 years now since we joined RTE around the same time in the early 80s. Now, one of my sons asked me a few nights ago who I'd be interviewing next, and I said Fintan Drury, and he immediately shot back, "Oh yeah, he's the guy who brought Ronaldo to Ireland." Somebody else might have said, "Oh, didn't he used to present Morning Ireland way back when?" Or, "He was a director of Anglo Irish Bank and a friend and confidant of Brian Cowan." And, "Oh yeah, he was chairman of Paddy Power." And, you know, it could go on. More recently, you're the guy who wrote that blistering analysis of Israel's war on Gaza, a book called Catastrophe or Nabka 2, Nabka 1 being the expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland when the State of Israel was formed. Now, so obviously, you've packed such a huge amount into your life, much more than I've mentioned. But it strikes me there is one thread going through it all that you've done, and that's politics. Politics are there, national politics, international politics, and there are some strong political roots in your family tree.
So my grandfather, Joseph Connolly, was a Sinn Féin member in Belfast at the turn of the century. And he stood for Sinn Féin in the East Antrim Westminster election of 1918, unsuccessfully, which is hardly a surprise. And he had taken part or attempted to take part in the Easter Rising. But in fact, he was the man who travelled from Belfast to Dublin and was told by Owen McNeill, who was given the countermanding order, to return to Drogheda, as far as Drogheda, and tell people to stand down, that the Rising was not proceeding. But he had travelled armed and ready to give his life. I relate in Catastrophe Nakba too, because I make some parallels between the Republican struggle and that of Hamas. I relate how he and his brother Alec, whom I knew very well later in my life, had chosen to take up arms. And he discovered Alec had taken up arms and was prepared to join the Rising only because he asked Alec to help him with his will. And it was then that they discovered in Belfast. And my uncle Alec became a first secretary or secretary general of the Department of the Taoiseach subsequently.
And your grandfather, Joseph Connolly, he was actually a member of founder member of Fianna Fáil and served in cabinet even though he was never a TD.
Yeah, I think he, I stand to be corrected, but I think he and Jim Doug are the only two people in the history of the state who have served as members of cabinet without ever being a TD. They were both senators, and De Valera chose him as Minister for Post and Telegraphs and then subsequently Minister for Lands.
You thought about entering elective politics yourself. You got a tempting offer, but I think you said, you know, wrong party, wrong time.
Can we talk about Ronaldo? No.
We'll come back to him.
Yeah, I was approached when I was presenting Morning Ireland. I was approached by the Progressive Democrats to stand in Dún Laoghaire, but having given it some thought and met with Des O'Malley, whom I would have admired insofar as one does as a journalist in those days, you know, admire from a distance. But ultimately, certainly the economic policies of the party would not have suited me.
You grew up in South Dublin. You had a pretty comfortable upbringing, it's true to say, I think.
Very. It was, you know, my father was a consultant in the matter. We had a wonderful upbringing. We lived in comfort. It was a privileged upbringing. And it's something I, you know, occasionally stress. And I think it brings extraordinary benefits in terms of education and opportunities, which other people don't get. But it also brings that counterbalance, which is to recognize that those are benefits, or to be taught as a youngster growing up by your parents, both by what they say and but also by what they do. And my parents were very good in that respect. And the small community around Clonskee at that time was of very good people who were all, you know, well off, but who all conducted themselves in a manner which was inclusive.
You as you say, had a privileged enough upbringing, but, you know, that didn't mean you were a softie by any manner of means. You're good at sport, you were well able to take care of yourself, particularly, I think, at the soccer pitch.
I beg to differ. I was a very poor, a very average footballer. And
League of Ireland level.
Yeah, huh? I got lucky though, Sean, or my teammates would say they got unlucky, because I was appointed captain of the club and we were preparing to play in the League of Ireland B, which was the standard that UCD had always played at the senior team. And I would have been adequate at that level. But that summer, there was a change in the makeup of the league and UCD was elected to the League of Ireland. And, if you know, there was no Premier and First Division as there is now. There was just one division. And because I was captain, I became captain of the League of Ireland team. And the best way I can explain, you know, my limitations is that when UCD won the FAI Cup the year after, they asked me to exit. So I had 2 years playing League of Ireland in a reasonable squad as definitely one of the weaker members of that team. But it was a fantastic experience and I have many friends who are, you know...
Politics was something you majored in at UCD and then you made the short trip across the dual carriageway to RTE. What was that like, your time in RTE as a journalist?
It was exceptional. I mean, it was something. It was what I always wanted to do. I mean, I grew up in a home where, you know, I was listening because I had no choice, even from a young age, to people I would subsequently work with, like Mike Burns and Kevin Healy, Jerry Barry, presenting the news at 1:30 or This Week on a Sunday. The radio was always on in our house and we were expected to listen and then discuss, you know, the issues of the day. And I had this kind of somewhat romantic notion of you know, being a correspondent and working overseas and even the idea of a war correspondent because it was, you know, Vietnam War was very much an issue at the time. And so there was a pull for me in that direction. And then I got lucky on two counts. One, RTE for the first time as I was completing my master's conducted an exercise where they took in graduates straight from college as opposed to, what you did, taking people in from newspapers. And that was the first time that they hired broadcast journalists and we were trained just, 200 metres from where this studio is in a beautiful old house by a wonderful woman called Una Sheehy. And we were supposed to do 6 months training. There were six of us. And there was an election called, so it was... I think we ended up doing 4.5-5 months. Conal O'Moran was one of them. The late, great Colm Keane, who was a close friend of mine, was a wonderful broadcaster, I'm sure you'll attest. So we were a select group. But I only discovered subsequently, many years later, that one of the things that had happened was that Maurice Manning, who was my tutor for my master's, or my supervisor for my master's, and Brian Farrell, who was one of my lecturers as an undergraduate, had both recommended me to RTE, and I only discovered that many years later.
It was made fairly clear to you in fairly blunt terms that you were headed for radio as opposed to television.
Yeah.
Unfairly, I would say, but however.
Oh, well, yeah, but, you might say that, others wouldn't necessarily. So what happened was at the end of this training course, there was we had to do mock sort of television, 9 o'clock news presentations as the newsreader and go through the whole rigmarole. And at the end of it, there was a panel of people who assessed how you had performed. And so when my assessment was very, very good from all of the experts until it came to Alpha O'Reilly, who was a very well-known figure in Dublin at the time because he not only worked in RTE as head of design, but he also worked in the Gate Theatre. And Alfo asked for the video to be paused. And he said, now, Mr. Drury, if you see the way, and I had hair back then, Sean, he said, you see the way your hair is brushed down towards your forehead. Please, if you're on television, make sure to brush it either to the left or to the right, because your head is shaped like a shovel. And to peals of laughter, or true peals of laughter from everybody, I said, but could you explain what do you mean? And he said, well, you're accentuating the shovel shape of your head if you allow your hair to be to just drip down towards the front.
I'm sorry I asked you that question, said you.
No, you're not.
In any event, the great thing about where you ended up, at least initially, was the news features department. People, as you say, like Jerry Barry, Mike Burns, Kevin Healy. And they gave people early opportunity.
Well, that's where you and I met. And I have more than once, unfortunately, never got the opportunity because Jerry died so young. But through my career in business, I really began to appreciate what those men had done for us as a group of young journalists. They were quite extraordinary. And I'm not sure they appreciated, realised how extraordinary they were. They were leaders. They led by example. They were exceptional broadcasters, very hardworking, but they also knew how to play. And they included us youngsters in their playtime. But more than anything else, they got out of our way. You know, they were household names who were presenting these programs, and they were brilliant broadcasters. But if they saw that Sean O'Rourke was good, or Fintan Drury, or Fergal Keane, they got out of the way and said, and encouraged us and helped us. And when you see, that's so rare in the business environment, in the corporate world, that level of generosity is rare. And when you see it, it is really remarkable. And I am forever in their debt.
You didn't stay long in News Features before heading to Belfast, I think, it's true to say. And maybe that was a natural career move for you, given your family history.
Well, the opportunity came up and it was straight after the hunger strikes. It was clearly going to be a fascinating time over the following number of years. I learned a huge amount. I worked with Jim Dougal, who was the head of the department. I worked with Cathal McCullough, who subsequently took over from me on Morning Ireland. And was a wonderful colleague and a great mentor and friend in a different way. John Deering, who was of the BBC, and then I think went back to the BBC subsequently. So again, you were, as a youngster, and I was still only in my early 20s, mid-20s maybe, I was learning a huge amount, but from people who were gracious about contributing to your development.
But it was a grim place to be working. I mean, the troubles were maybe not at their height, but there was still an awful lot happening and a lot of killing and a lot of bombs and no end in sight, arguably.
Absolutely. And we were also working, all of us, not just the people in Belfast, we were also working under censorship, which for, you know, younger people listening to this might be quite interesting to consider that, you know, there was a decision taken by the government here, which was followed by the government in Britain, or maybe it was the other way around, that we would not be able to interview and could not broadcast interviews with members of prescribed organisations. And I've often reflected on this since and how weak we were as a group. We should have been much more vocal. We should have stood up for the need for those people who were involved in the armed struggle that we could access them and be trusted to interview them and get to understand what it was that motivated them to take a similar approach to the constitutional nationalists whom we knew and interviewed and respected, but that they felt they had to go another way. That was an important piece of the understanding, and we were prohibited from doing it.
You co-presented Morning Ireland with David Hanley in the relatively early days, not initially, but when the programme was still establishing itself. How did that go? Or how did it come about?
I was very lucky. I was, really, and this is something you're going to hear me say a lot. I think I've been very fortunate. Breaks have gone my way. So I was asked to come back from Belfast to co-present the programme, which was due to start in November 84. And I had a conversation with Jim Dougal, who didn't want me to leave and who also suggested to me that what I had been asked, promised, if you like, which was that I would co-present the programme with David Hanley, whom I hardly knew at the time, that wasn't, you know, confirmed. And anyway, I came back. Moved back to Dublin and relatively soon discovered that Jim was right, and that there had been pushback from you know, other people within the news environs who felt that I hadn't yet achieved the necessary steps or delivered to a particular level, that therefore I shouldn't be the first presenter with David Handley. So I was dropped, as I thought. I was used to that in football, but not in my career to that point. I was dropped as the presenter, and I had a very difficult conversation with the head of news at the time. And the consolation was I was sent to the United States to cover the presidential election of 84 between Reagan and Mondale. That was a pretty good consolation prize.
And it's a long road that has no turn. And relatively soon afterwards, were sharing the studio with Handley.
I think the point there is that, so David Davenport, who was another good colleague of ours, David Davenport and David Handley started the programme in November. I was in the studio in Washington, sort of almost co-presenting that first morning. And the programme got off to a pretty awful start. And it was difficult because the Irish people were used to Mike Murphy.
Yowza, yowza, yowza. Do you remember that?
I do. And I know and love Mike well. But
and Mrs. Miller. We're showing our age here.
He was wonderful. He was a gifted, gifted broadcaster. And that's what the Irish people were used to. So Morning Ireland comes along out of nowhere. They have an hour of talk and they didn't like it. They rebelled. And so there was a lot of pushback. Got to the point where the then chairman of the authority, Fred O'Donovan, spoke publicly about maybe they would be taking it off air, which was really a shocking thing to have said. And in the midst of all of that, as the adjustment was happening and people were getting used to it, a decision was made to bring me in. And I always think that one of the reasons why I got the gig was because, as you would appreciate, Handley had a very deep, gravelly voice. But David Davenport's broadcasting voice, wonderful broadcasting voice, was not that dissimilar, whereas mine is a different tone. And so by the time I was brought on, which was in January of, you know, the following January, when I was brought on to co-present with Handley, people had started to adjust to this change from yowza, yowza, yowza to, you know, this is Fintan Drury and David Handley with Morning Ireland. And I got lucky again, because in fact, if I had been there for the first few months, I'm quite sure I would have hit the skids. You know, it would have been very difficult.
My mother always had one piece of advice: me, mind your good job. Now, you had a good job in RTE at the time, Morning Ireland, a fantastic career ahead of you. But as you've written, I think without deeply considering the matter, you left broadcasting, you left journalism. Why?
I have no idea. I mean, I have no idea. Really, there was no particular reason. There was no, you know, deep unhappiness. There was no, this isn't what I had expected it to be. There were a couple of things that happened, which I've written about, you know, like not getting, I wanted to work in television, despite what Alf O'Reilly had said. And I thought I was going to get a job in Today Tonight, and I misjudged that. Again, I write about it.
You screwed up the interview.
I was arrogant. I thought from a conversation I'd had with Joe Mulholland that the job was mine. And that was arrogant. And I went into the interview.
You weren't the last.
But I went into the interview thinking the job was mine and faced the wonderful Michael Heaney, who didn't think the job, who thought I had to earn the job. And I didn't earn it. And so, but that wasn't why I left. There were a number of other things happening at the time. Anyway, I left.
Yeah, I mean, you very quickly you had set up your own firm, Drury Communications, but did you do a stint with another firm?
I did, with Bill O'Hurley. So I joined Public Relations of Ireland, which was then one of the top sort of two or three firms in the country. And Bill was great. I mean, he was such a big personality. And his partner, Pat Heenahan, who was also a very well-known person around Dublin at the time, was, you know, every bit as big a personality. But Bill wasn't for sharing any of the equity. And I remember saying to Pat at the time that I left the company, you know, that I'd had this conversation with Bill, which I talked about, you know, participating in the equity in the business at some point. And Bill said, not now, not ever, never. And that was it. And so I set up Drury Communications.
With a good friend of yours, Billy Murphy, yeah. And it thrived.
It thrives. It's still there today. And Billy has done an extraordinary job. First as chief executive, now he's chairman. The company is still bizarrely trading under my name, but it's trading very, very successfully and has a wonderful reputation. In fact, I can't remember, I think it was 25th birthday, or maybe it must have been 20th or 25th birthday celebration for the company, I was invited, and Billy spoke really very nicely about me and about the origins of the business. And you know, I took the microphone and said, this company should be called Murphy Communications, not Drury. So, you know, its success continues, but I sold out after 10 years and left completely. And, you know, so the
but in the course
is
of
nothing
that,
to do with me.
In the course of that time, that decade, you did manage to establish some good, strong contacts and good opportunities. Not least, I think, although I think it was more a sporting setting, that you met Sean Fitzpatrick, who was then and had been for many years and continued to be afterwards chief executive of Anglo-Irish Bank.
Yeah, the first time I met him was the late, great Tony O'Neill, who was in charge of football in the university and then subsequently took over as director of as its first director of sport, had set up a development board for sport in the university, and I was on it. So was Sean. That was the first time I met him.
Did he cast a spell on you?
I think the honest answer to that is maybe. I think that, but I don't think that would, you know, there's an implication in that, which is that it's kind of deliberate. He had an extraordinary personality. He was a man who really, he was a short man, but he filled a room, and in a manner which was very attractive. So if he cast a spell on me, it was around how enchanting he was, how bright he was. Very, very, very bright man. Mm. Great company. Self-deprecating. Very, very warm. And, you know, super capable. And quite decisive.
Before he invited you to join the board of Anglo, I think you did some work with them. I mean, on what basis were you qualified or suitable? What did you do for Anglo?
Well, we handled the public relations for Anglo right through when it, you know, was floated, and we managed it, I think, very successfully. And when you're working at that level, you're working on pretty important strategic issues. It's not just the, you know, the press release or talking to the press. You're dealing with, you know, the chief executive, the chairman, board members. And so you can get involved in a very deep way, and you get an understanding of the bank, and you get an or the business, whatever business it is. And we would have done the same with CRH. We did the same with Jury's Hotel Group. But with Anglo, it very much was, you know, it was going through such extraordinary growth. And so when I finished as chief executive of Drury Communications, Sean was very anxious to keep me involved. But I, you know, I had left public relations. I had left Drury Communications. Drury Communications continued to represent Anglo, and Billy, who had been doing most of the work actually on Anglo before I left, even though I was still involved, Billy just, you know, moved in and did all of the work now as opposed to most of it. But Sean wanted to continue the relationship with me. And around the same time as he started talking to me about the potential to go on the board, I was approached by Stuart Kenny to go on the board of Paddy Power. And the two discussions ran in parallel for, I'm guessing, about a year. But interestingly, in the case of Anglo, to your point, the point of your question, in case you think I'm avoiding it, when Sean first brought my potential appointment to the board, the chairman, Peter Murray, who was a fine man, decided, when he was planning to bring it to the board, the chairman decided that it wasn't appropriate. And he decided it wasn't appropriate because of our relationship and our friendship, if you like. And there was a real friendship there. But then if, you know, passage of time, another 6 months goes by and the issue came back again. And I think the question you asked about competency is a really good question. And I don't know, other than this, that one of the things that Anglo had was a plethora of people who were skilled, highly skilled in particular areas. They didn't have a generalist. And I would always have put myself forward as a generalist, you know. And I think that that is a valuable person to have on a board, even a board of a very, you know, large company and of a financial institution. So it came around again. And at that time, I had been asked by Stuart and the board of Paddy Power, you know, there had been a definitive offer made. I had accepted that offer. And so I ended up becoming a director of Paddy Power and Anglo pretty much at exactly the same time. And then subsequently, I became chairman of Paddy Power. And that happened simply because Stuart, who was chairman, didn't want to be chairman anymore. And the conversation was held around the boardroom table. And Ian Armitage, who was the institutional, the largest institutional shareholder, decided that it should be me.
And reflecting on all of the things that went wrong, particularly with Anglo, one of the things, one of the lessons you drew is trust nobody, take nothing at face value. But shouldn't you be able to trust people with whom you work?
But of course you should be able to. But my experience is that there is a massive risk attached to that. And the risk is that if you're a non-executive director of a business and the executives don't share everything with you, you are, by definition, exposed. It probably happens pretty much all the time. And the chances of you being exposed are pretty slim. Events don't happen like what happened with Anglo.
So is it possible to protect oneself then?
Fully bulletproof? No. In my opinion, no. If you're doing your job as a director, a non-executive director, your job isn't to protect yourself. Your primary job is to protect the interests of the shareholders. So when I reflect back on Anglo and Paddy Power, I'm more upset about Paddy Power. I did a phenomenal job for Paddy Power, for the shareholders.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to that. Yeah,
but I should never have taken the job on, because before you talk about shareholders and about fulfilling a responsibility to shareholders in a business, you've got to be morally sure that this is a business that you're comfortable working with. I never put myself through that test with Paddy Power.
When you were on the board of Anglo, Fintan, what was the attitude or the atmosphere in the boardroom and among the executives towards the regulator, towards the central bank? I mean, how seriously did they take their responsibilities, or how wary were they of falling on the wrong side of them?
Well, it's a long time ago. Truthfully, my memory is that there was absolutely no issue in terms of, you know, full disclosure and consulting with the central bank or the regulator at any point when that needed to happen. And I remember there was an issue with the bank had subsidiaries, one of which was in Geneva, and there was an issue with, you know, not a particularly complex, but a concerning issue nonetheless for the board. And, you know, the decision was the first thing we need to do is go to the regulator there and make sure they understand that we're concerned about this issue. And there was no pushback from management. But equally, the engagement with the regulator, with the central bank, was, from my perspective as a non-executive director, was as full as it needed to be.
You say in your book, your first book, Seesaw, that there was one individual who repeatedly warned you about Sean Fitzpatrick, but he was the only one. What was the nature of his concern?
You don't miss much, do you?
I did a bit of reading.
The nature of his concern was he wasn't involved in banking. He just knew him through business. He knew him through life. And he said to me, this was way back, you know, we probably had just started working together on the board in UCD. And this man would have been around UCD as well. And he said to me, don't trust him. Never trust him. And I, you know, listened to him for a while and then, you know, just thought he was a grumpy old, you know what, and that he had some kind of issue with him. But I often thought about it since and said, you know, maybe he knew something.
Yeah, and told you as much as he felt he could possibly disclose without breaking confidence or something like that. You talk as well in the book, and I think in interviews as well, of having developed a corporate strut. Describe that.
I can show it to you. it's just that sense of, you know, I'm not saying that it's a conscious thing, but that when I reflected back on that period of my life, which was, I'm talking about, you know, 2002 to 2010, you know, a lot of stuff was going really well. I had, you know, been appointed to the board of two large, very successful Irish companies, because Anglo was extremely successful. And I was also chairman of one of them. I was involved in the sports business that was going through, you know, huge growth. You know, we did the Ryder Cup. We staged the Ryder Cup. We'd done two American golf championships in Mount Juliet. We brought Ronaldo to Dublin. So all of that sort of stuff.
And you were chairman briefly of RTE, but then on grounds of principle and conflict of interest, you had to give that up after,
correct,
what, 6 months?
Yeah. So you probably unconsciously develop a kind of a sense of yourself, which is beyond what it should have been. And it's about ego. And, you know, you and I know as men that that's an issue that we have to deal with more than women. But it was, you know, my ego got inflated. And I don't think I ever became a pain in the ass, you know, corporate dude, anything as bleak as that, at least I hope not. But I certainly did, you know, behave in a manner which was more comfortable than I should have been and less questioning. I'm not talking about in board meetings. I'm talking less questioning of myself than I should have been.
You left the board of Anglo after 6 years, refusing to continue on. That might have been an option. And that was about what? Was it about 6 months before the bad stuff really hit the fan? But having left 6 months earlier, it didn't actually save you from all the opprobrium that was to follow the collapse of Anglo and all that came afterwards.
No, nor should it have, because what happened and what came afterwards, you know, had been in the system. I mean, this wasn't something that just landed on Anglo in December of that year. But I did, I hope, stress in anything I've said or written that I left because I had finished my second 3-year term.
You didn't, there was no bad smell?
Absolutely not. It was, you know, it was my time to leave, and I was asked if I would stay on, and I declined because I had said in my very first chairman statement in Paddy Power that the maximum directorate, non-executive directors should stay in any business is 2 3-year terms.
You, even after the collapse of Anglo, you remained on good terms with Sean Fitzpatrick, but then all of that was blown out of the water because you, I think, felt betrayed and very angry about what you discovered he was at.
Yeah, very simple. He had approached me saying he was thinking, and he'd been encouraged by some of his mates to write a book, and he was facing criminal cases at that time. And asked me what I thought. And I said, I think that would be really, really bad move. I think there is nothing you can do that's going to advantage you in terms of public perception right now. And what you have to do is just face into the criminal cases and come out the other end of them and then see where you are. And that was like a really firm conversation. And he came back to me and said that he appreciated it and he largely agreed, but some of his friends had suggested to him that, you know, it wasn't the right advice. And I said, well, look, why don't you talk to somebody else? And I suggested another public relations consultant who was still trading as a PR man. And I subsequently, Sean came back to me then and said he had spoken to this man and that the advice was exactly the same as mine. And he therefore thanked me for it. And then, I don't know, 8 months later, he contacted me and asked me to come meet him. And he told me that he had written the book.
More egregiously, I suspect, was the fact that it was subsequently discovered that he was taking his personal loans out of Anglo at the times when the audits were being done and parked them, I think the phrase was bed and breakfast wise, with Irish Life. Were you shocked by that?
Absolutely. I think everybody on the board was shocked by that. I mean, this comes back to the question of Trust. So you have a board meeting once a year at which people are asked to sign off, and they're given a piece of paper in front of them, is placed in front of them with their loans. And they have to check that those are correct. And then they sign the document to say that they're correct. And then they're accumulated and they're put into they're aggregated and put into the annual report. But what I didn't know, none of us knew, was that every year when that was happening, Sean had moved some of his loans, a percentage of his loans, to another financial institution for the period under review, so that he was signing a document which was accurate on that date as to what his loans were. But then when that period ended, the loans that had been bed and breakfasted came back to Anglo.
Looking back at your period with Anglo, you wrote about having to endure a stress that was degenerative of body and soul. Explain that.
It was a period of years where you were, your dominant thought was fear about, the implications of what had happened to Anglo. And as somebody who had, pride in his professional life and the way in which I had conducted myself or attempted to at all times, I knew that I had missed something significant. And however many excuses I could make for having done so, by my measure, I had failed. And, the fact that I was involved in something as massive as the collapse of a financial institution, which cost the taxpayers such significant sums, was, deeply distressing.
And side by side, or in addition to being a board member of Anglo, there was also the fact that you were a close confidant and friend of the then Minister for Finance, then Taoiseach Brian Cowan. That presumably added to the opprobrium.
Yeah, and added to, as you can understand, and I understand as a journalist, the factor. There must be something here. And then most people will know that there was a game of golf which I organised in Druids Glen. I mean,
What is it about golf? Go on.
Yeah, I know, poor Sean. But as I said to the people in the banking inquiry when I gave my evidence, forget about Fintan Drury. Is there anyone here in this chamber or in this room who sits in the chamber that believes that Brian Cowan would do anything to damage the interests of this state? And I mean, to me, I know I wouldn't, but I also knew for sure that, what I was dealing with Brian was somebody who has the interests of the state are above everything, anything and everything else. So there were a series of coincidences that looked terrible. There was nothing you could do about them. You couldn't deny that they had happened, but all you could do was protest that actually nothing happened. And there was absolutely no discussion on that day. And there were others there who have testified to the same, that, there was no discussion about Anglo at all.
We'll talk more a little later about Brian Cowan, but come back to what you said earlier about what worried you most was not so much Anglo, or not so much worry, but the bigger mistake was ever getting involved with Paddy Power.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it many times since. I do think there's a big difference between the gambling industry then and the gambling industry now, and that's, thanks to the internet and smartphones, etc. But even still, I was high on the fact that I had worked with Stuart and the guys from very early on with the development of Paddy Power and right through into the flotation. And then here I was, not just a consultant, but being asked to become a director. And, it was also fun. They're a really good group of people, and they're good fun to work with, and they take it very seriously, and they're very concerned about the shareholders, all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, but yourself and Stuart subsequently, you're like a pair of reformed alcoholics in the sense that you look back and say, God, we should never have done that, and betting is really bad, it's dangerous, we wouldn't want Paddy Power impinging on the lives of our children or anything like that. I mean,
so what's wrong with reformed alcoholics? I mean, ultimately, if you want to reform something, and it is reform that we're looking for, okay? It's not stopping people bet. You know, as far I never bet, but I think Stuart still does have the odd flutter. But what we're talking about is the degree to which the internet has enabled gambling, the gambling industry, to become, you know, ever present in people's lives and young people's lives. And particularly, there are some particularly odious practices that the gambling industry is today involved in, and they know they're involved in it.
Such as?
Well, I mean, a very simple example, it's the one I tend to use. If you're at home, you know, and you're watching a football match or a GA match, and you want to place a bet, and you place a bet, you know, just to give you an extra bit of interest as to who's going to win this match or not. And you will then get a ping offering you a free spin on the roulette wheel. Now, sports betting does have a level of skill involved. People can use their acumen or their knowledge of the particular sport to make a judgment as to who's going to win or who's going to score the first goal or whatever. But spinning a roulette wheel has none. It is a complete game of chance. There should be a clear delineation between the sports betting and the casino. And you should not, as a betting company, you should not be allowed or able to invite your sports betting customer to have a free spin on the roulette wheel.
Come back to Brian Cowan. Your background's totally different. He grew up in the Midlands, a proud Offaly man, culture you might say. You, a city boy. What brought you together?
Like a lot of things, chance, you know. We knew each other in university, but not. A lot of people have written the fact that we were friends in university. We absolutely were not. Hardly knew each other. I wrote to Brian when we were running, myself and Billy were running Drury Communications, and we started to do a lot of training work for politicians when Haughey was Taoiseach. We trained the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party, and Brian was one of the people. I was doing the training. It was in, you know, how to do your job in the Dáil, given that it was Oireachtas TV was about to happen. And he was one of a group of four that I would have trained. And we sort of connected then and started meeting every so often. And then when the first Aer Lingus crisis happened, and he was Minister for Transport Communications at the time, and I got a phone call from a man called John Lockery, who was Secretary General, and he said, would I come in and chat to himself and the Minister, which I did. And I started working, or Drury Communications started working on advising the department at the time.
And subsequently, you stayed in touch. He became Minister for Foreign Affairs, then Finance, was Minister for Health as well, obviously, and then ultimately Taoiseach. You've spent a fair bit of time, though, advising him, writing speeches. Were you in pretty much daily contact at a certain stage?
Never daily contact, but regular enough contact. And I was kind of like an extra advisor, unpaid advisor. You know, we had become close friends. We shared a lot of views, you know, about politics and social issues.
And he's great company.
Oh, he's phenomenal company, yeah. But, you know, his intellect is extraordinary, and his capacity to get things done when he puts his mind to it is extraordinary as well. I mean, I think, you know, he's often to pick a department where he clearly struggled, like most people, which was the Department of Health. I mean, he did a phenomenal amount of work for mental health when he was there. So there were things that he was determined to change within the Department of Health and place a focus on. So even in a department where he didn't do that well.
He called it Angola.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think it's also important to stress Garrett Fitzgerald, a figure from the distant past, who was a, you know, revered, I think, Taoiseach and Minister for Foreign Affairs. He wrote a piece in the Irish Times many years later saying that Brian Cowan was the best Minister for Foreign Affairs Ireland had ever had. And that was, you know, that was across the aisle praise.
At what stage, was it very early on after he became Minister for Finance that you began to push him in the direction of basically trying to displace Bertie Ahern?
Yeah, pretty soon after.
So talk us through that. I mean, why would you have done that?
Well, I believed in Brian and I didn't believe in Bertie Ahern.
From when?
Well, from some time previously, yeah. But I mean, my belief in Brian was total. And I believed he was what Fianna Fáil needed, which was of less importance to me than the fact that I believed he was, you know, what he would serve the country very well. I also thought he would shift our, even though he didn't do it when he was Minister for Finance, I felt that he would shift the balance from the economy and only the economy and from a particular type of economy to a more balanced approach. I believed that he had, you know, the intellect to do that. I believed that that was where his heart and his instinct was. And I believed in the right scenario, he had the capacity to do it.
He firmly resisted that, though, didn't he? Correct. In the same way as he resisted your notions of standing for election, telling you, no, not you, not you, Drury.
Yeah. I mean, he put me in my box more than once about that. You know, he said, absolutely not, you know.
But why was he so reticent about planning or plotting against his leader?
That's not in his DNA. I mean, you know him, Sean. Brian has some very admirable qualities that are of a, you know, different time, and one of them is loyalty, and his loyalty to party is something.
And also,
that
he would have witnessed the upheavals as a young TD in the 80s and 90s. Charlie Haughey, Albert Reynolds, all of that, from which he benefited, I suppose, when Albert became Taoiseach. But he didn't want to go back to that.
I don't think it was that. I mean, I don't know. I don't recall ever discussing that with him. But you know, loyalty, as it should be, was a very, very important thing to him. And as far as he was concerned, whatever reservations he may or may not have had, Bertie Ahern was the Taoiseach and he was loyal to him.
You wrote that Brian Cowan was absolutely horrified at the humiliation of Gráinne Ruth, and then when he got back, you and he got together, and effectively Brian Cowan presented Bertie Ahern with a fait accompli, in other words, time to go. Is that how it was?
If it wasn't how it was, I wouldn't have written that and published it in Seesaw. I mean, that's you know, a very clear account of what happened over those few days.
You and he worked together on deal with that.
Yeah, I spoke with him. He was overseas. Again, it's documented in Seesaw, but, you know, it was a friend. It was two friends talking, one of whom was Minister for Finance. I was, you know, not surprised, but I was nonetheless horrified that this woman had been, as I saw it, humiliated, or faced a degree of humiliation, certainly public humiliation. And Brian's view was similar.
So what did you decide with him to do about it?
No, he decides. I mean, you know, I'm...
Okay, what did he decide?
Well, I mean, I think it's obvious what he decided to do in terms of what happened subsequently. He decided to have a conversation with the Taoiseach when he returned, which is what happened.
And you prepared an aide memoir for him,
yeah,
before that meeting. And then he went and had the meeting with Bertie, and he contacted you. So did he describe in detail what happened in the conversation?
No, and I didn't ask because it's not my business. That might seem sort of...
Yeah, because I'm fascinated by this in the sense, Fintan, that in Bertie's book, for instance, his memoir, he says there's been a lot of speculation about whether Brian Cowan tried to push me out during that meeting. And he said if Brian had wanted me to go, he definitely didn't say it to my face. And in fairness, I think it was clear that he was going to end up as Taoiseach anyway, but I felt that he was keen for me to stay a bit longer.
That's Bertie Ahern's account. I wasn't there. I wasn't in the room. I know what happened in terms of the discussion I had with Brian, the meeting I had with Brian before he
But
went
do you think
there,
Bertie's version there is a fair reflection of what you understand to have been the conversation?
But I wasn't there.
Yeah, and then I did an interview with Brian Cowan for a series I did a couple of years ago called Two Tribes.
Yeah.
And in the course of it, I said, look, can you tell me about your own role in Bertie Ahern's decision to resign as party leader when he did? He said, well, I hadn't a role in it. And he said, I'm often asked, it said, you know, oh, by the way, Bertie Ahern was pushed. Bertie Ahern was not pushed. Was he nudged by you? I asked Brian Cowan. There was no nudge by me, said Brian Cowan. It was a question of at times when I'd have discussions, and we had many discussions up and down, but I never once would be so disrespectful or so presumptuous just to say that. So,
Yeah, well,
it's all a ticket of smoke.
It's but that's, you know, that's politics everywhere.
Opened. Do you believe that Brian Cowan gave him a nudge?
I mean, what I believe is what I wrote in Seesaw. And the, and
well, if people don't have it to hand as they're listening to this, so...
Well, that's fair enough. But the reality is, I gave an account of what happened on that day. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the discussion was around the appropriateness of Bertie Ahern staying involved, staying as Taoiseach and leader of Fianna Fáil after what had happened at the Moriarty Tribunal. That was a discussion which I had with the Minister for Finance at the time after he returned. And he went to the meeting with Bertie Ahern, and subsequently Bertie Ahern stood down as Taoiseach.
And do you believe the timing of that was related to the conversation he had with Brian Cowan?
Absolutely.
Because Bertie wrote...
I know what Bertie Ahern wrote, and I know that the evidence that Bertie Ahern gave to the banking inquiry, I didn't know it when I was giving my evidence, but I learned of it subsequently. And I'm quite clear as to the events of that day.
You expected, and I think you wanted, to get a job from Brian Cowan. But to quote my former colleague and good friend Pascal Sheehy, a dumb priest never got a parish. You didn't actually ask him for a job.
Well, there you go.
And you weren't offered one?
No.
Why? Did you ever ask him afterwards? I mean, long after he left office.
You know, his answer was as loquacious as some of the answers you've already quoted from your interview with him. They were, you know, of course I asked him. And we, you know, we had a laugh about it. Oh, I never thought you'd be interested. You know that. You know what he's
Why
like.
Didn't you ask him?
I just never really felt comfortable asking him. You know, this wasn't asking somebody for a job in, you know, their shop or in their business. This was, you know, this was the Taoiseach. This was somebody who's going to lead the country.
The challenges facing Brian Cowan as Taoiseach were as serious and as weighty as those facing pretty much any of his predecessors. It wasn't seen as a successful period. Maybe it wasn't going to be successful for anybody. Where do you think it went wrong for him?
It wasn't a successful period. He didn't do the job that he was capable of doing. But I think his greatest regret is, and it's for him to say, but I think his greatest regret is that he didn't do more when he was Minister for Finance to... you know, close down some of the excesses that were happening within the country and which were the fault of Fianna Fáil-led administration.
Are you talking about the construction industry and tax breaks and that kind of thing?
Yeah, but again, I don't want to speak for him. I think the other thing is that clearly timing, you know, timing does matter in one's life. And I think he was unfortunate in that respect. But I think also his, you know, his unquestionably his almost obsessive need to manage across the whole range, across the whole spectrum of what was his responsibility as Taoiseach.
Was that an inability to delegate?
I wouldn't say inability, because if he had complete trust in people, then, you know, I found him to be, I would have observed him to be good at delegating, but it wouldn't have been a strength. There would have been a natural pull away from that, which is difficult to curb if it's your natural disposition. But it's absolutely critical to leadership to be able to delegate. And so it's not his, you know, his natural thing, his natural way. But he's not opposed to it. He's not opposed to giving people their head or giving people responsibility, as I recall.
One of your observations about him was that he wasn't sufficiently ruthless to do the job as Taoiseach.
Well, that I'm certain of. And I had one, and I'm not going to get into it, but I had one particular example of that where, you know, he was determined on a particular act, and he discussed it with a number of people who were close to him. I was one of them. And everyone agreed that it was the right thing for him to do, and it was appropriate. But it was the only example, but it was a pretty stark example. And you know, ruthlessness is critical. Our mutual friend Sean Dagnan, who worked so closely with Albert Reynolds, I think would say that for all Albert's bonhomie, and he was a very warm and engaging person, he had the capacity to be ruthless.
And there wasn't just the financial collapse of the country, and we had to get the Troika in to help us sort it out, and there was the bailout and so forth. I mean, that must have been extraordinarily difficult for Brian Cowan, not least because you talk as well, or have talked about him having what you describe as the worry gene.
Yeah, and I relate to it because I have it myself. And I think, you know, he's always been, as long as I know him, you know, he's a worrier, which may be contributed to, you know, his ill health and suffering the stroke, as he unfortunately did. So I think, you know, in his general disposition, he would be a worrier.
There was also the infamous interview in Morning Ireland from the Fianna Fáil Think in Galway, which led, I think it was Simon Coveney, to describe the performance as sounding like, you know, halfway between drunk and hungover. What did you think of that?
I thought Simon Coveney's comments were appalling, inappropriate, and he, you know, let himself down.
I suppose you yourself refer to his preference for a pint at the end of the day. I mean, was there an unfair judgment made of Brian Cowan?
Yes.
Do you want to expand on that?
Not really. I mean, it's a yes or no question, really, isn't it?
But you did say as well in Seesaw that he came to the job of Taoiseach really at a time when he was tired. He'd been in a ministerial office for 13 years. And what he needed most of all at that stage was a break. But that was never going to be an option, was it?
No. And I mean, this is one of the issues that I tried to raise in Seesaw. I don't think very successfully, was around the whole question of how we treat our politicians and how we view politics and how well we cater for them. And, you know, I've made the point in the book that when people have worked as hard as Brian had worked in professional services companies, they're, you know, they're given a period of time off on full pay. We slag off our politicians all the time, and we're always given out about them. I'd be in that group, you know, from time to time, for sure. But we need to stand back, and if we want to get more from the body politic, if we want to get more from our legislators, we need to treat them with greater respect, and we need to create the work together to create conditions that make it easier for them to move on from those 13 years to become Taoiseach and not to be absolutely worn out.
Was there another inherent difficulty or something that pointed to him not really being a suitable fit for the office of Taoiseach? And you say that he didn't really have the burning desire to lead.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And I think that's both a positive reflection on him in the sense that, you know, for all his ability, there was a level of humility, and is a level of humility about Brian. It's not always evident, but it is there for sure, where he is prepared to accept, you know, he's perfectly happy to work alongside people. And I think that, you know, leaders need something special. I'm not an expert on that, but I've...
But it's akin, really, if you look at someone like, say, much more recently, Pascal Donoghue. Pascal Donoghue, obviously a successful Minister for Finance, 10 budgets and so forth, but never showed interest in, that we know of anyway, in wanting to lead his party or become Taoiseach.
It's a very good comparison. I don't know the man, but I've remarked to a number of people how often I've passed him, you know, around Merrion Street and that area. And, you know, you pass him by and he always looks happy and contented. I mean that in a serious way. And that, I mean, it's not, Fine Gael aren't my party of choice, but he's a very, comes across a very likeable, together, content person. And that makes for somebody who's going to make good decisions and is going to be on top of their brief. So I think that is a good comparison, because he doesn't necessarily want to lead. Maybe he quietly does, but the need isn't there. And actually that need was never evident to me in Brian.
Very interesting observation that. Before I ask you, Fintan, about your much more recent book about the Middle East and particularly Palestine, tell me about your time in sports management and promotion and looking after people's interests. I mean, that was something that you started in this country. I think you set up Platinum One.
Yeah, well, initially it was Drury Sports Management. It was an offshoot of Drury Communications, and it happened very shortly after I had set up Drury Communications. I was approached by Liam Brady and Kevin Moran to advise the Irish footballers who were about to qualify for the World Cup in 1990 and to advise them on their commercial potential. And we took that job on as a kind of an adjunct to Drury Communications. And it went really, really well. And through that, some of the players in that squad asked me to represent them. And I did a small amount of that kind of work. And then we did the same for them again in 1994 when they qualified for the States, the World Cup in the States. And through that, we started to build a business. And it was the first full-service sports management company in Ireland. And we started to work. A young executive at the time, Paul Holland, suggested to me that we look at golf. We started talking to the European Tour in Wentworth. We wanted to create a new golf event in Ireland. Out of that came the European Open, was moved from Sunningdale in England to the K Club. And we managed the European Open for 13 years. And we staged the American Express Championship in 2002 in Mount Juliet, which was won by Tiger Woods. And then in 2004, it was won by Ernie Els. And in between, or sorry, just after that, we did the Ryder Cup in 2006 in the K Club. And all along that time, we were building the business in the UK in terms of representing players and gradually started representing rugby players. And around 2007 maybe, we made some pretty bold expansion plans, and I forced it through against the advice of one of my director colleagues, Johnny Fortune, who was more experienced than me. I should have listened to him. It didn't really go that well. So, you know, I often reference that in terms of people see things as being, see you as being a success. That I know it's an old cliche about you learn more from your mistakes, but it's true. And, you know, so we made a number of decisions, and then, you know, the business moved exclusively over to the UK and became exclusively involved in football. And it's still trading today, very, very small number of clients. I'm kind of gradually winding it down. I'm almost as old as you, Sean, so it's time to hang up me boots.
No, as Kevin Moran probably said to you, as he said to me on one occasion, don't let the old man in. You got to keep going, you know. Yeah.
So that's in short order.
And you represented rugby people as well. Yeah, I mean, painfully, I think at the end, Johnny Sexton.
Well, it was probably painful for Johnny as well. But I write about that in Cecil. But, you know, I worked with Johnny, and what an extraordinary athlete and an extraordinary man. I love him to bits. But he fired me, you know, and it was cold and calculating. As I write in the book, you know, it was like as if I was just between him and the line, and he just burst through to touch the ball down. There were, I'm going to it now.
It had to do with him coming back from Paris to play rugby at home.
Here, and the IRFU didn't want me involved, and you know, and anyway, it in the overall scheme of things, small stuff. But I also think it's important to stress that when I did Johnny's deal from Leinster to France, within a couple of weeks, I did a deal for a young 18-year-old Scots boy from Aberdeen to Bournemouth. And Bournemouth were in the third tier of English football at the time. And the fees Platinum One earned from that deal were in excess, significantly in excess, of the fees that were earned from doing Johnny's deal to France, which made him one of the most highly paid players in the world. So, you know, it just does no comparison.
To come to far more serious matters, one of the things you've been working on recently is researching and writing about Palestine, and particularly in the light of events that began with the 7th of October 2023 and Hamas making that attack on people in Israel, killing, I think, about 1,250 people, taking over 250 hostages, and all that flowed from it. You take a very strong view in your book, Catastrophe, Nabka 2, that, look, this current phase didn't begin on the 7th of October 2023. Its roots go far, far deeper.
Early in the book, I asked the question, what was life like for Palestinians on October the 6th, 2023. And I list a whole series of oppressive actions that the Israelis had been taking for many, many years, decades, against the Palestinians to squeeze the life out of Palestinian society. And so I am very clear that the Hamas attack was brutal and it was a war crime, but it was understandable. And you've got to recognise that all over the world, when people are oppressed over a lengthy period of time, and if the levels of oppression are as deep and as offensive and as destructive as Israel's conduct towards the Palestinian people for generations, it is inevitable that as much as the percentage of the population will want to go exclusively the constitutional route, if that's even possible, which it's not really in Palestine, there will be a percentage that will say, we can't take this anymore, and they will take up arms.
Not just understandable, as you've said a few moments ago. You say in the book that given the decades of oppression by colonialist Israel, it was justifiable. That's quite the statement, in the sense that, like, lots of people say it was understandable, but justifiable in terms of all that followed and flowed from it, which I suspect you would say was entirely predictable, the way the Israelis reacted.
I don't think it was entirely predictable. And there's nothing in the history of Palestine and Israel since the Nakba in 1948 to suggest that there would be anything of approaching the scale of what has happened in the last 2+ years and is continuing to happen. The genocide is continuing as we speak today. And the reason I say there's nothing, you know, there was no reason to believe, is that the Nakba in 1948, 15,000 people were killed, 750,000 people were displaced, made refugees. I mean, 15,000 is a nothing compared to what will be the outcome at the end of this. And if the idea is that what the genocide was caused by what Hamas did on October the 7th, 2023, I absolutely don't accept that.
But what do you think?
But all of the evidence is that if you look at all of the, you know, the intifadas, and if you look at the Six-Day War in 1967, if you look at all of the evidence to date, there was no basis on which you could have imagined that Israel would conduct what they have conducted for the last 2.5 years and been allowed to do so by the international, not only allowed to do so by the international community, but also the most critical piece of all of this is they couldn't have done it without the international community and without the sponsorship. So when people talk about,
particularly the United States
and Britain and Germany, if you look at this word complicity that is used all the time.
But what must they have expected was going to happen? I mean, when they crossed the border on the 7th of October.
That's my point. If you look at the history, right, then, you know, there's 1,800 people killed in this situation. There's 5,000 or 50. But the Nakba, which was a catastrophe, involved the death, the killing of 15,000. So nobody could have, including Hamas, have considered that the outcome would be as it is. And also, and this is the really critical point for us here in the West, is to, for once and for all, accept that there has to be a line drawn between the moral compass that we see as being our world, our Judeo-Christian world, and accepting that there are other worlds out there, there are other cultures that are out there that are as valuable, as rich, and need to be protected.
Yeah, but Israel is surrounded by countries, none of which is democratic.
You're not going to tell me Israel's a dem. The last time I was in RT on this issue, I was cut off because I made a comparison between Ukraine and Israel, and I was cut off and told, you know, Ukraine is a democracy. They're, you know, Israel's a democracy. I said, Israel's not a democracy. Yeah, absolutely, it is.
Well, they do have elections. There are also guarantees, or there are limits, albeit ones which Netanyahu's government tried to burst through, with the Supreme Court having a restraining power. It's still got it just about.
Sean, with respect, it is not under any definition a democracy. It is an ethnocracy. Why? Because its laws, including its more than just its laws, but its practices in terms of education, for example, or accommodation, issues that we would have known well about in Northern Ireland back in the day. Those issues are managed in a way which is apartheid. Why? Why? Because 20% of the population are of the population of the state of Israel, of the not the occupied territories, are Palestinian Arabs, and they are discriminated against in education. They are discriminated in terms of against in terms of work.
Sure. But
by the way, just as I'm on a roll, when Iran and Israel had their skirmish for 12 days, which the Americans contributed to in the summer, last summer, it's a little known fact that the highest number of fatalities from Iranian bombing of the bombs that Iran dropped on Israel was in a suburb of Tel Aviv. And the reason why the numbers were high, relatively speaking, was because the bomb landed on an Arab area of Tel Aviv where the people don't have bomb shelters. So when the sirens go off, because they are Arabs, their accommodation doesn't have shelters.
Yeah, but there's also, I mean, you talk about it goes back to 1947-48. But there's also the 1967 war when Israel managed to expand its control over territories. But they didn't start that. And the point is made, and you use the word genocide, and Irish government ministers use it and international politicians. Genocide, I think, you know, the definition is intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial or religious group. And there was a piece in the Telegraph a few weeks ago by the chief rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregations of the Commonwealth, a man called Ephraim Mirvis, who says, look, that is a word that should not be used. And that, in fact, one of the consequences of this race to linguistic escalation, the Manchester attack on Yom Kippur, and more recently, much more recently, what happened on Bondi Beach.
These are, first of all, I wouldn't read the Telegraph. If you want to understand anything that's happening in the Middle East, it is utterly biased towards Israel. It is among a number of establishment newspapers. And we have issues here with the media coverage in Ireland as well. However, the professor of Holocaust history in the University of Jerusalem, the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, has written a very extensive piece, which he wrote over a year ago, where he said, this is a genocide. And he is regarded as one of the leading experts. He's a Jew. He works in the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And he said, it's a remarkable piece, but he is among a very significant number of Jewish academics who have said, this is a genocide. The other issue here is that the notion of anti-Semitism, this is deliberately used by the state of Israel and has been for decades as a means, using their Hasbara, their propaganda, to conflate anti-Semitism with criticism.
It's obviously a subject which will continue, if you're writing another book, to absorb your interest for some considerable time ahead.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's, to me, it's the most, and you know, when you go back to our early days in the 80s as colleagues and friends, you know, this is the biggest crisis that I have seen in terms of a belief in our system of our values. It's the biggest crisis because it challenges everything that we believe in, which is, you know, human rights and the value of the human life.
Fintan Drury, thank you so much for joining me on the Insights podcast. And you can find more Insights with Sean O'Rourke on the RT Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you for listening.